I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. The Berks County Residential Center in Pennsylvania has detained migrant families seeking asylum in the U.S. for years, and now it's empty. 25 people, including 15 children, were released this week and are living with families and sponsors in different parts of the country where they will continue their appeals for asylum. Berks is one of three family detention facilities run by the federal government and long the target of immigration activists lobbying for the facility to be closed. In fact, Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey tweeted this week, "The next step is to permanently close the center so that no future family or child is forced to go through what these families have endured." Joining us is WHYY's Laura Benshoff, who has covered Berks. Laura, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. How long has Berks been a family detention center?
Berks was a nursing home for a long time, and then in 2001, the federal government awarded the county a contract to turn that nursing home into a family detention center. And so it's more or less been running that way ever since. Originally, it was conceived of as more like a processing center, a place families would stay for a few days or a couple of weeks. But as we saw, you know, depending on the administration and the policy, sometimes families could be detained there for very long stretches, months or even years.
And these were families or are families, or I guess were families, since there's nobody there, that have been or were seeking asylum?
Most recently, yes. It can be kind of hard to generalize just because there's a few different ways families would end up in the Berks Center. One way would be, as you said, if you are a family unit that arrives at the U.S. southern border, you request asylum, you might be sent to the Berks Center for some kind of processing to sort of like do medical screening and some other screenings, and you could be released to go through your case or you could end up staying there. But it was also a place where if families arrived at airports, you know, there's huge international airports on the East Coast and didn't have the proper visas or went there and was trying to claim some sort of status, they might also be transferred to the Berks Center. But in general, yes, we've seen a huge uptick in families often leaving the Northern Triangle in Central America who would go to the U.S. southern border, request asylum, and then be sent to these three family detention centers.
And they're run, or they were run by ICE?
They were run by ICE. They were kind of the county was involved. The county actually staffed it, but the contract was with ICE. So it was a kind of local, state, and federal government were all implicated in the center in some way.
Interestingly, Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania talking about that no future family should have to endure what these families and children endured at Berks. What were conditions like there?
So I've interviewed families there over several years, and I visited, and the best way to describe it is it kind of felt like a dorm room or a dorm building crossed with a public elementary school. But, of course, you can't actually leave. So, you know, there were bedrooms with sort of twin beds. There's a cafeteria. There's a computer area. There were a couple of classrooms, and the Berks County Intermediary Unit, sort of the body above the public schools in Berks County, did send teachers out. But I think even though it sort of had some of the nicer trappings than other family detention centers, critics have long alleged that, you know, it's still an oppressive environment. Families I interviewed would talk about the food being bad, you know, flavorless or nearly rotten. Their kids wouldn't eat it, or they would have issues sometimes with, you know, their kids would get sick and there was a medical wing, but they felt like their concerns weren't always taken seriously in that wing. And so it definitely was always touted as the nicest of the three family detention centers, but it still had a reputation, especially for long-term stay families, to be pretty rough. And there was one policy, actually, that probably drew the most fire, which is a state policy, which is every 15 minutes throughout the night, there would be bed checks. So someone would walk around, shine a flashlight over the families, look into their bedrooms. And the families described that as just an incredibly invasive practice. You couldn't get a night's sleep.
Now, these were families, I mean, obviously coming to the United States, but not charged with criminal violations, and yet obviously were not allowed to leave Berks.
That's correct. You know, immigration law is civil law. It's not supposed to have penalties that involve losing your liberty the way that, violating a criminal law does. And there was a lot of law and court cases fought in the past to try to ensure that those stays would be short. You know, kids are not supposed to be detained for more than about 20 days under a consent agreement between attorneys who monitor the centers and the federal government. But we've seen several administrations violate that, unfortunately.
And do you know what the longest stay was?
Years.
Years.
I don't know off the top of my head. I interviewed a woman, I want to say in 2017 or 2018, who got to the Burke Center when her son was maybe 2 and left when he was 4.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's empty. So what happened?
That's a really good question. You know, we saw more direct messaging around the other 2 centers. So there's 2 in Texas, and you know, it was sort of announced or leaked that those centers would be turned into processing centers or reception centers, something that indicates, you know, more short term, more, you know, this is a stopping point, this isn't a detention center. And there hasn't been an announcement made yet about the Burks Family Residential Center. The Reading Eagle did report that there was a, you know, white paper circulating, something, you know, the county's going to look for bids or proposals of things they could turn that building into. Hmm. So, you know, it may potentially have a different future, but we're just, the details of that are not known at this point, and there's been no official announcement about it.
So do we know, was it just sort of one day people were, what, boarded onto buses or put onto airplanes and sent somewhere?
Pretty much. I mean, it takes a little bit of time to coordinate with people's family sponsors. Some people may have taken a bus. Some people may still be in the community. One thing that can happen is if someone doesn't have a family member who's immediately ready to take care of them and sort of vouch for their safety and well-being, is they may end up in the home of someone who's in a network of churches in the Berks County area that have sort of taken in, taken responsibility for helping folks who are applying for asylum. Some people may have flown all across the country. People from the center have gone to Texas or Indiana or New Jersey in the past.
So living either with sponsors or relatives or family?
Generally family. Like I said, occasionally someone may not have a family member who's immediately ready to take them in. And then there are often these, you know, somewhat social justice oriented networks of churches who may band together, and people will offer up space in their home on a temporary basis. But generally people have family members that are already in the U.S. who are in a position to take them in, can provide them, you know, room and board while they get on their feet. And that's really what, you know, what advocates would prefer is the default, as opposed to putting families in a detention center.
And that's Laura Benshoff, WHYY reporter. And she has covered what is the official title, the Berks County Residential Center in Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. And for a number of years, it detained migrant families, many of them seeking asylum in the U.S. And now it is empty. And we're talking about what happened, where these families might have gone, and certainly the fate of Berks itself. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. And in about 5 minutes, we'll be talking about the Biden administration's approach to immigration, how different it is and isn't from the Trump administration. Laura, as you said, the families, including, I think it's 15 children that I read, so 25 mm-hmm. people, and 15 of them were children. Will they be then seeking asylum or some kind of citizenship from wherever they're living now?
Yeah, they're almost all certainly in court proceedings of some kind where they're going to make a case for why they should stay in the United States. And, you know, that they may not be successful ultimately, but the numbers do show that whether you're if you're not detained, you still show up for your court hearings. That's sort of one of the main reasons why detention kind of came into favor, is it was seen as somehow more secure or more reliable for getting people to show up. But there's been a lot of studies to show that if people know the stakes of the court case, and if they have someone helping them navigate the system, like an attorney or a caseworker, upwards of 80% of families who are released into the public, released to their family members, will show up, will go through sometimes a months or years long process to try to prove their asylum case or what other claim they may have.
What do you make of the timing? I mean, we're about a month into the Biden administration. Do you think this was some kind of policy or a reaction to a new administration in the White House?
You know, I hate to speculate, but it certainly seems that way. I mean, you know, one of the first moves Biden did on his first day in office was to sign some executive orders around immigration. You know, he's been pushing a huge overhaul bill to, you know, provide a pathway to citizenship for longtime residents of the U.S. who don't have status here. You know, and he was criticized a lot on the campaign trail because of, you know, as President Obama's vice president, Obama really ramped up family detention. And Biden kind of had to answer for the consequences of that and all of the negative attention that that drew to, you know, that former president. And then coming off of the Trump administration where detention wasn't used quite as much, but it was still a tool, definitely a tool of a kind of restrictionist, you know, pact that the Trump administration had. I think Biden is really trying to cut a different figure. But he has challenges. You know, it is really hard as a government to know how to respond when you have sometimes hundreds or thousands of vulnerable children and families with children right. who are arriving at a border. It takes a lot of infrastructure to treat people humanely, to make sure that they are fed and safe. And a lot of that infrastructure is still missing. And so it will be really interesting to see how the Biden administration tries to adapt and change these structures. And it certainly seems like he intends to do that.
And I'll be picking up on that very point, Laura, when I talk with our other two guests. And just about a minute before we have to say goodbye, is this a big facility? And as you mentioned, it was a nursing home before it became a detention center. What do you imagine will happen to Berks?
You know, there was a plan actually a couple of years ago floated to potentially turn it into, some center to treat opioid addiction. You know, it could have another therapeutic use. It is set up, you know, similar to a nursing home or a place where there are many small private rooms. I think it could have a lot of different futures. It just sort of takes the political will to make that happen. And certainly there's a lot of needs in Berks County. So I'll be very curious to see what happens going forward.
Me as well. Laura, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Wonderful. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's a WHYY reporter, Laura Benshoff. And we are going to take a very short break. And as I just mentioned, we'll be talking about the Biden administration and its approach to immigration policies. And we've got two guests who are waiting in the wings. In the meantime, you can always join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. On February 2nd, President Biden signed three executive orders reversing some of former President Trump's immigration policies.
With the first action today, we're going to work to undo the moral and national shame of the previous administration that literally, not figuratively, ripped children from the arms of their families, their mothers and fathers at the border, and with no plan, none whatsoever, to reunify the children who are still in custody and their parents. The second action addresses the root causes of our migration to our southern border. And the third action, the third order I'm going to be signing, orders a full review of the previous administration's harmful and counterproductive immigration policies, basically across the board.
Immigration has been a contentious political issue well before the Trump administration, with fights over a path to citizenship for undocumented migrants, over DACA, the wall, deportations, asylum seekers, worker programs, sanctuary cities. Well, today on Radio Times, what the Biden administration is planning to do to address some of these longstanding issues. And we have two guests who have joined us. Adam Goodman is Assistant Professor of Latino and Latin American Studies at the University of Illinois, author of a book called The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. And Adam Goodman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Sarah Pierce is a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, also a former immigration attorney. And Sarah Pierce, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah, let me begin with you. Just kind of a broad-based question, but Adam, I'll toss it to you as well. How much clout does a president have to change or create immigration policy? Sarah?
A significant amount, and that was never more clear during the Trump administration. So President Trump was the most active president in modern times on immigration. And from the executive side, without any help from Congress, he was able to enact significant change across the system.
Through things like executive orders?
Through things like executive orders, policy memos, even just changing the guidance that goes to immigration officers on the ground. There's a variety of strategies you can use, and his administration was extremely smart about taking advantage of all available options.
How do you see presidential authority on this issue, Adam?
I see it in a similar way. I mean, I think my research and work has shown that, you know, executive branch authorities have exerted extraordinary control over immigration during the last century and a half, in fact, and, you know, made critical decisions about who's allowed to enter the country, as well as, you know, who's allowed to remain. And they've, you know, wielded this power over the deportation machine and over the lives of non-citizens, permanent residents, and affected many citizens' lives as well.
And what is this deportation machine? It's the title of your book, but what does that mean?
Well, I describe this long history during the last 140 years in which the United States has deported 57 million people. I mean, we need to do much more than reverse the policies of the previous administration. And this is a bipartisan history. Democrats, as well as Republicans, have been responsible for implementing punitive policies. And something really startling I came across in crunching some of these numbers was that during the last century, the United States has deported more people than it's allowed to stay in the country on a permanent basis. So I hope that the Biden administration is able to push hard and reverse many of the policies that Sarah and her colleagues tracked that the Trump administration put into place. But they shouldn't stop there. They should go well beyond that and, you know, undo the punitive policies that have, you know, long shaped immigration policy.
Well, let me put some policies out there. And Sarah, I'll go back to you. And I think we can mostly agree that really one of the most horrifying and egregious policies of the Trump administration was the child separation policy. And at one point, I think something like 5,000 children were taken from their parents during a zero-tolerance period. I know the Biden administration wants to find those children and reconnect them with members of their family. But Sarah, how do you see this policy, and how easy do you think it will be for the Biden administration to fix it?
So I completely agree. Family separation was one of the most egregious policies that came down during the Trump administration. And the difficult thing right now is there was a huge focus on the children who were separated from their parents during the summer of 2018, during the zero tolerance policy, like you said. Most of those children and parents have been reunited. The issue is that there were family separations occurring even before that summer. And the federal court, which has put a lot of attention on this issue, those children, it didn't arise to their attention until several months after that. So these, you know, 500 remaining families that are still separated have actually been separated for a very significant amount of time, 3 years or more at this point. So that is why this group has been so difficult to reunify. It's been so difficult to find these parents, many of whom were deported years ago. And it's great. It's very heartening to see this administration put together this very smart task force to focus on it. I'm very hopeful that they'll have success.
Let me toss that back to you, Adam. And the ACLU, I know, was very actively involved in trying to reconnect these families. But how did you see that policy? And what do you think the Biden administration can do even beyond a task force?
I do think it's important to recognize the ways in which the Trump administration was historically bad and really abysmal and did so much damage. I'm not trying to give them a pass by any means. And I am encouraged, like Sarah as well, about some of these early initial indications the Biden administration is really shifting direction and staking out new ground. I think one of the challenges we see here is that there's a lot of bureaucratic inertia, regardless of who's in power, regardless of which party or president. The immigration service, they're tasked to enforce immigration laws and to apprehend, detain, and deport people. And until we see their mission shift more toward providing services to immigrants as opposed to enforcing these punitive policies and laws, I think we'll run into these same problems over and over again. So that, inevitable inertia becomes really challenging to break away. But there's also resistance that the Biden administration, we've already seen, is facing from within the Department of Homeland Security. They can roll out really progressive policies that indicate they're going in a different direction. But if the rank and file aren't on board, it's oftentimes difficult to implement those policies on the ground.
And the rank and file, meaning Democrats in Congress?
Sorry, no, the immigration agents, Border Patrol, ICE agents in the communities, they may receive new direction about who they should be targeting for deportation, yet they still hold an extraordinary amount of discretionary authority to decide who to apprehend. And once someone is caught up in the deportation machine, it becomes very hard to find legal channels for relief.
Sure. Let me ask you, and this is something actually that Laura Benchoff raised in talking about the closure of the Berks detention facility, as it was called here in Pennsylvania. The question is, what do you do with, let's say, children, unaccompanied children, and there are unaccompanied children arriving along the U.S.-Mexico border. What do you do to provide the services that Adam was just talking about, but also to determine their status, where they should go, what do they need? Let's say a 14-year-old girl or a 14-year-old boy, what do you do? What do we do?
Yeah. So what we do right now, the system that we have in place, at least for unaccompanied child migrants, is not necessarily a bad one. When an unaccompanied child migrant arrives at the southern border, they're apprehended into custody if they don't have authorization to enter. But then they should be quickly transferred to the Department of Health and Human Services, which is designed not to enforce immigration laws, but to provide services. First and foremost, they're trying to find sponsors for that child throughout the United States, ideally a parent or a close family relative. And if not, they have the facilities to house the children while they're going through the immigration process. Now, during the Trump administration, HHS was definitely used as a tool of enforcement. For example, sponsors risked coming into contact with immigration enforcement if they came forward to claim any children. So that's a really big problem. But the infrastructure in place can be good. It can be a good process to help these children if it's used properly. But family detention, that actually is a separate beast all in itself.
And what, as a beast, should these places be permanently closed?
Yeah, I'm all for that. We've seen, time and time again that, and I think your reporter spoke to this really well, that if you have proper case management, if you help guide people through a very, very complicated immigration court system, they show up for their case proceedings and they abide by the final decision. You don't need something as horrific as family detention in order to do that properly. And I think, rather than focusing on detaining families, we need to focus on making our adjudication system more efficient, so these families aren't waiting for years to have their cases adjudicated, but rather only a few months. That alone would increase the efficiency of the system and increase, the participation.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We've got a lot of people that want to join our conversation. That's Sarah Pierce. She's policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, a former immigration attorney. Also with us, Adam Goodman. He's an assistant professor of Latino and Latin American Studies at the University of Illinois. Wrote a book that came out last year, The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. And again, you can join us. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me just read a couple of emails, and then, Adam, I want to go back to you. Stu says, you asked, this is pointed at me, you asked if Biden was living up to his promises. Give me a break. He's only been in office a few weeks. He has to undo 4 years of destruction. Here's an email from Edward. I hear that the country has to undo Trump's immigration policies, but what are the negative effects of flooding the country, suffering from the pandemic, high unemployment, and an economy hard-pressed to those living here illegally? And Adam, I wonder if you could take that question.
I think what we see throughout U.S. history is that we've oftentimes welcomed immigrants as laborers. We oftentimes have not allowed them to remain in the country on a permanent basis. And immigrants have been used as a convenient scapegoat. I mean, we certainly saw the Trump administration, you know, pointing the finger at immigrants and non-citizens, as opposed to addressing, you know, broader problems of creating jobs, expanding the economy. And the reality is that it's not so easy to separate the supposed us from them. Mm-hmm. Immigrants and non-citizens' permanent residence lives are intertwined with those of citizens. So these policies, you know, exact a cost on all of us. And what we also know is that immigrants have revitalized our nation's economy. You know, cities like Philadelphia and others in the Rust Belt have actively recruited immigrants to come to repopulate, you know, these deindustrialized areas and to build the economy. And that's something that I think we need to keep in mind, that despite the fact that they're oftentimes used as scapegoats, and who is targeted and the reasons why has changed over time. But this is something we really need to break from, and I think, you know, shift the paradigm.
Well, and this, I'm sure, has been said before to you, Adam. I've certainly said it as well, which is we praise ourselves as a nation of immigrants. And yet, as you have described, we have deported 57 million immigrants. Was that in the last 100 years?
And that's exactly right. I think there, you know, there's serious questions that, you know, that realization, you know, brought up for me, and I explore in my book, you know, what kind of nation is the United States, you know, the supposed nation that has welcomed immigrants throughout its history. And I do think that at this particular point in time, the Biden administration has a real chance to pivot and to break from the past. I do think because immigration politics have become more polarized during the last 4 years than in recent history, there is a real opportunity for change that we maybe haven't seen before. And that's something that we should continue to push the Biden administration to follow through on. I agree with the other, caller or the person who emailed about, you know, it is still too early to say.
Right.
But that at the same time means that we need to continue to push the Biden administration to follow through on its promises. The question here is all in the follow through. I mean, they've said so many encouraging, wonderful things. There's less certainty as to whether they'll follow through and implement those policies. But we do know the Biden administration is more susceptible to pressure from activists, organizers, and the immigrant community. And the key now is to keep that pressure up moving forward.
And to you, Sarah, I mean, there are certainly rhetorical differences between the Trump and the Biden administration. As you look at our immigration policy, what do you, and if it's possible to prioritize, you know, what should be done first? And it should be said that there is some resistance coming from the U.S. Congress, including coming from Democrats. But if we want a humane and effective immigration system, what should we do to make it better?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. If you're talking about the president and his administration, they have a long to-do list before them. The southern border certainly needs a massive amount of reorganization, which they've started doing, but their focus so far has really been on unwinding Trump's policies, where we need, you know, some more forward-thinking action at the southern border. We need a system that's not only designed to deter and detect unauthorized crossings, but also to accommodate vulnerable populations and efficiently process them. then the legal immigration system was severely restricted under President Trump, and we have not seen the Biden administration acting on that very much so far, which is understandable. It's still very early, and there isn't even a director of our legal immigration agency, USCIS, yet. So they have a long to-do list there, and hopefully they'll be able to get started soon. But the real reform really needs to come from Congress. We haven't had legislation on immigration other than enforcement in really 3 decades. We need a broad legalization program, just like the one that President Biden has put forward himself. But we also need significant reforms to our legal immigration system. And that will, you know, help the whole system come back into balance and operate more efficiently.
Adam, looking at a Politico headline of, I think it's from this morning, not quite ready yet. Democrats won't take up Biden immigration plan this month. And I mentioned to you sort of where the resistance is coming from, but it's clearly there is still resistance in the U.S. Congress. And I'm thinking about, and we have about a minute before our second break here, about those who are undocumented. I know Biden wants to create a pathway to citizenship. He's not the first president to talk about that. What do you think the status and future of that issue is?
I agree with Sarah that it's absolutely key. And this is, you know, perhaps the most important piece of the legislation among the many pressing issues that the Biden administration needs to take up. But, you know, a broad legalization program for the estimated 11 million undocumented people living in the country, would change the lives of so many for the better. And it's very difficult to get this through Congress right now, given the narrow margins the Democrats have. But it is what they should be focusing on. And, you know, they should also be thinking about providing expanded legal channels for people to enter the country in the future so that we're not back right in the same place 20 or 30 years from now. And, you know, this is something that, we do need to wait and see. But at the same time, it's discouraging to hear Democrats sitting on their hands when each and every day that goes by, you know, people are removed from the country, they're separated from their families. Deportation exacts a cost in the here and now, and we should be pushing for changes immediately in addition to trying to transform the broader system.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Adam Goodman, who joined us along with Sarah Pierce. We're talking about immigration policy and what would create a more effective and more humane immigration policy. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with our guests about immigration. Adam Goodman, Assistant Professor of Latino and Latin American Studies at the University of Illinois, author of a book titled The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. Sarah Pierce is a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. She's also a former immigration attorney. Let me play another clip, and this is brand new, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas at a White House briefing this week, claiming that the Biden administration has inherited a broken immigration system.
To put it succinctly, the prior administration dismantled our nation's immigration system in its entirety. When I started 27 days ago, I learned that we did not have the facilities available or equipped to administer the humanitarian laws that our Congress passed years ago. We did not have the personnel, policies, procedures, or training to administer those laws. Quite frankly, the entire system was gutted.
Sarah Pierce, is he right?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're just looking at asylum and the refugee system, which are, you know, two limited parts of the immigration system. Under the refugee system, President Trump lowered our refugee intake to the lowest level since the creation of the U.S. refugee program. And that had other results as well. The vast resettlement network across the United States that typically accepts and integrates those refugees has been cut down by a third. Then on the asylum system, President Trump essentially ended asylum at the U.S. southern border, and restarting that is going to take a long time.
Let me read some comments, and then, Adam, I'll give you a chance to respond. An email from Paul who says, the Biden approach, is the Biden approach just an anti-Trump agenda, or is there a clear, cohesive policy? Seems they're opening borders, et cetera, with no plan, telling immigrants to please wait for a while before they come in. Let me just read a couple of more. One from Doug, I'm concerned the Berks, which we talked about earlier, can once again be used for family detention, and that ICE still has a contract. A question from Dave. President Biden's immigration executive order was partially stayed in court. Does this refute the notion that a president has significant influence over immigration policy? Adam, can you take that last question? And this is related to migrants along the U.S.-Mexico border. It's a kind of complicated legal situation, but can you respond to that?
I mean, I think that there's real opportunity here for the Biden administration. I agree with Sarah that the challenges they're facing are extraordinary, and certainly unprecedented in recent history. And one of the things we see is that, and I've heard some people put it this way, and perhaps it's helpful. The Trump administration dedicated so much attention, energy, and resources into dismantling our immigration system, legal, authorized and unauthorized, and the Biden administration would have to perhaps push and dedicate an equal amount of resources into building it back. And whether or not they'll follow through or not on all these fronts is a big question. But I am encouraged to see them not just responding to Trump and trying to undo the policies of the last 4 years, but I think what we see is kind of the effects and the product of 15 plus years of sustained organizing and activism. And the Biden administration's legislative proposal to Congress, as well as some of these executive actions and orders, I do think reflect that sustained pressure over the last decade and a half.
Here's a comment from Dan. I'll put it to you, Sarah. He says, we need to address the problems that force people to migrate in the first place by making life unbearable. We need to stop the drug gangs by decriminalizing drugs. But there, I know the Obama administration was trying to address some of that in the countries, that are along our southern border, trying to change conditions so that people don't feel like they have to run for their lives in order to survive and protect their children.
Yeah, that's right. Since 2014, arrivals at our southern border have switched from mostly Mexican nationals to mostly nationals from the Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And during the Obama administration, there was a significant focus on addressing conditions on the ground in those countries. And a lot of it was led by, at that time, Vice President Biden. So that's been one great thing, is to see that he's been consistent with that approach and is trying to bring that in. Because, of course, a lot of those programs were gutted during the Trump administration. Even aid to those countries were gutted during the Trump administration. So it's been very exciting to see that come back, because that's definitely an important part of a holistic and properly functioning immigration system.
And let me put this back to you, Sarah, about people seeking asylum in the United States. My understanding is under the Trump administration, things like domestic violence, even gang violence, was not a criteria for getting asylum. Do you think that will be changed, or has it been changed?
It has not been changed yet. So President Biden has signed a lot of executive orders, but many of them are just issuing reviews and actions yet to come, just like Adam said. And one of those actions yet to come is a real examination of the definition of asylum and who might qualify, which was severely restricted under President Trump. So there's that, kind of vague indication that they will open asylum back up to victims of gang and domestic violence and other types of non-state violence. But we have yet to see that change.
Adam, I mean, it looks like more people are arriving at our U.S. border, either wanting entrance for asylum reasons or other reasons as well. If we loosen some of these laws and we're more welcoming, more people will come. And do we have a system that can manage that?
I think the Biden administration needs to invest, incredible amount of resources into this, asylum adjudication program and investing in that. Certainly nothing, simple or straightforward, but really essential. And, one of the callers, your comments earlier about, you know, people showing up at the border and requesting entry, I think it's important to distinguish here. Most of those people, the vast majority, are asylum seekers, right? They're not just immigrants who are, you know, seeking to come to the United States for whatever reason, but they're people seeking asylum. And by U.S. law, by international law, you know, they have the right to do so. And it's, again, discouraging to hear Secretary Mayorkas encourage people not to come right now, because, you know, that actually goes against the laws that are on the books.
Sarah, you were an immigration attorney. Just how complicated is it to determine someone's status, their reasons for coming to the country, all the, you know, all the details that have to hold up in a court of law?
Yeah, it's extremely complicated. And I think one of the craziest parts of the process is that migrants are not given attorneys to go through this process. Many of them, even children, are navigating the immigration court system alone, even though the asylum process is extremely complicated. So hopefully, you know, yet another change on the long list of wish list of changes we'd like to see under President Biden is increased counsel to immigrants going through this process.
Do we have enough attorneys and judges and court staff to be able to manage that?
That is a good question that we're looking at right now. I mean, certainly the easy answer is no. We don't even have enough judges. So the backlog in the immigration court system exceeds 1.2 million cases. It's close to 1.3 million. And we don't have enough judges to get through those, which is why, like I said earlier, these asylum cases pend for years when really we should be able to get them done in a few months. So one thing we've been pushing is for the administration to instead have asylum officers adjudicate these applications rather than putting them into this massive immigration court backlog that they'll just sit in for years.
That would be someone, maybe not an attorney, but someone, you know, well-versed in the system?
Yeah, we actually have an entire corps of asylum officers that work for our U.S. immigration agency, USCIS. They already adjudicate asylum applications, just a different type of asylum application.
Adam, one of our listeners has a question for you. Is Adam in favor of open borders? What kind of border control does he propose?
I mean, I would propose a system that acknowledges the realities that, you know, people are going to continue coming to the United States, regardless of the policies on the books, and that we should create more legal opportunities for them to do so, whether that's through our asylum and refugee system or through the legal immigration system. I mean, the best way to handle the quote-unquote problem of unauthorized migration or illegal immigration would be to reduce the number of people that have to come without authorization, and expanding the possibilities for people to do so. And whether that's to provide the labor that we have always depended on, or whether it's to reunite with families, or any of the number of reasons why people might come to this country, those who are fleeing political violence, who are fleeing natural disasters, I think that creating opportunities for people to come to the country would be a way to minimize the number of people in the country without authorization. So any kind of legislative reform would need to include, you know, terms that would allow people to regularize their status who are currently in the United States, as well as avenues for people to come in the future. And I think that's really the key, because we've seen this historically. People, regardless of, you know, how welcoming or punitive the policies are in the books, they've continued to come for any number of reasons, including the United States and employers recruiting them. So we should recognize that as a fact and then adjust our policies accordingly.
How do you see that, Sarah?
Yeah, I agree to a certain extent. And I feel like I've said the word efficiency so much over our time together. But I mean, that's really what we're lacking at the southern border. We have this system that's designed to address the flows we saw in the 2000s, where there was a large number of single adults trying to come into the United States, evade detection, and work in the country. And that's just not our reality anymore. And yet, the enforcement system is still designed for that reality. So we need updates that allow us to humanely handle vulnerable populations, to let them in if they qualify, and to humanely return them if they don't. And yes, we absolutely need legal reforms that allow more people to come to the United States legally. It's in both their interest and our interest.
Sarah, I'm looking at a headline in the paper today about a California crash tied to migrant smuggling. This was in California. I think something like 19 people in a suburban caught fire, but it was all part of this smuggling operation, and they were apparently able to get through a hole cut in the border fence in order to get into the United States.
Yeah. So one thing we haven't talked about yet is the fact that President Trump issued this order from the director of the CDC that mandates the expulsion of all unauthorized arrivals at the southern border, including asylum seekers. And surprisingly enough, that order is still in place today.
Wow.
So that has increased reliance on smugglers who, if they have the ability to get migrants across the border and entirely evade detection. When we're allowing people to apply for asylum, they don't need to evade detection. They need to really find a Border Patrol agent. But because that order is still in place, there's this huge need to evade detection. So there's a huge increase of reliance on smugglers who can try to help migrants do that.
Can I jump in briefly?
Yeah, please go ahead, Adam.
Sorry, I was just going to say, you know, one of the things I really surprisingly discovered was that deportation without due process, these expedited, streamlined removals, this has long been the American way. The United States federal government has created administrative mechanisms and legal mechanisms to speed up the deportation machine and to limit the rights of people who are fighting for the possibility to stay in the country. And, some of the numbers really, shine light on the Obama administration, for example, in which 80% of the expulsions during the Obama administration happened through a number of expedited mechanisms. And so in some ways, the Trump administration's policies, build on that long history. And there's some continuity there. And the Biden administration thus far, as Sarah mentioned, has continued that. And I think providing people with more legal rights and the possibility, to have their cases heard and to fight for a right to stay in this country, would be certainly an important reform.
Adam, let me tell you something that Karina put on our Facebook page. She said we need to rewrite the 1967 asylum law that only allows for asylum based on religion, race, nationality, and political opinion. Does not reflect the modern reality of the insidious takeover by the cartels in countries in Central America and West Africa. Do you agree?
I do think.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no,
go ahead,
Adam. And that sounds like you agree as well, Sarah. But yeah, go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, go ahead, Sarah.
I'm curious to hear Sarah's thoughts on this. I'll just briefly say that I think that the asylum system is actually an extraordinarily narrow and strict and restrictive, and we should expand it.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, that definition was created in the wake of World War II, focused on a very specific population in Europe. And countries, this is actually an international issue that many countries have wrestled with, whether or not to expand asylum and how to do so. And there's a lot of agreement that ideally you want all countries to define asylum the same, so you don't have people hopping from different nation to different nation to try to qualify it or as they flee persecution. So I definitely think we need an update, ideally internationally across the board, but even in the United States, we can modernize our definition of asylum to better match other countries that have kept up with the times.
Let me squeeze in one more comment, one from Meg. We focus so much on our southern border, but there are lots of other sources of illegal immigration, including people overstaying work and education visas, for example, which are different from asylum seekers. Adam, do you have a quick response to that?
I think that's a really crucial point. Some people cross the border without authorization. Many others, overstay visas, as the commenter, observes. And I do think that it speaks to this larger problematic fact about our immigration enforcement system, and that's that it's disproportionately targeted Mexicans and more recently Central Americans, as Sarah mentioned, and created problematic ideas about who belongs and who doesn't, who's an American and who's not. And this prototypical idea of, a Latino or Latina immigrant as an illegal alien, I think that is in large part through the historic disproportionate focus on targeting those individuals for apprehension removal.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us on Radio Times. Adam Goodman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's an assistant professor of Latino and Latin American Studies at the University of Illinois. Wrote a book called The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. Sarah Pierce, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And she's a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, a former immigration attorney. We appreciate all those comments to Radio Times, a very interesting addition to our conversation. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.